Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're diving deep into exam access arrangements in the UK, you know, for the 2024-25 school year.
Big changes are afoot.
Yeah, huge changes. So whether you're a sensitive teacher, parent, or just someone who, you know, is interested in education, this deep dive is for you.
Yeah.
We'll be dissecting a presentation by Nick Late,
head of examination services at the JCQ.
Right, the Joint Council for Qualifications,
yeah,
to
yeah.
bring you all the need-to-know info about these changes.
And I think you might be surprised by what's changed. This isn't just like an update to the regulations.
Right.
It's potentially like a turning point in how we think about inclusivity and personalized learning in exams.
Exactly. And one of the biggest shifts that Nick talked about was, you know, the move to interactive, accessible JCQ regulations online.
Yeah.
And that seems like a small thing.
Yeah.
But it's actually a huge deal for SENCOs and, you know, really anyone who supports students in school.
It is. I mean, like, how many times have we seen that really important guidelines have been missed because they were buried in a really dense document? So this is a digital makeover, basically.
Yeah.
Makes it clear, searchable, and readily available. And it really empowers SENCOs to get to grips with those guidelines and then make good decisions for the students they're supporting.
It's like having a GPS for, you know, navigating the world of exam accommodations. But mm-hmm. ultimately, like, it's the SENCO who's in the driver's seat.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something else that Nick really emphasized.
Right.
The importance of professional judgment for SENCOs.
Yeah.
It's like the regulations provide a framework, but it's up to the SENCO to determine, you know, which arrangements are actually needed for a student based on their individual needs.
Right.
And the impact of their disability.
Yeah.
So it's not just a tick box exercise.
Right. It's like really understanding that student holistically and coming up with a tailored plan to support their success.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting that Nick mentioned the most common question he gets from SENCOs isn't about understanding the rules.
Mm-hmm.
It's, what do you think I should do?
Yeah.
So it just shows that even with those guidelines in place,
right, there's that need for reassurance
mm-hmm.
and recognizing the weight of those decisions.
Yeah, because ultimately, they are the ones advocating for the students' needs and ensuring a fair assessment process. And the stakes are high.
They are.
Because this isn't just about the exam. You know, this can impact a student's future opportunities.
It's a really important point.
Yeah.
I think we need to think about the connection between access arrangements and future employability.
Right.
So the skills that students develop through those accommodations,
mm-hmm.
so things like self-advocacy,
right,
time management, learning how to utilize support systems, you know, they're really valuable in any workplace.
You're right. It's almost like we're preparing them not just for exams, but for life beyond school.
Exactly.
Yeah. And with those changes come new responsibilities, and staying updated is more important than ever.
Yeah.
And Nick shared a story about a SENCO who caught a mistake in how some schools were interpreting the rules for supervised rest breaks.
And it really just shows how important continuous professional development is.
Yeah.
You know, even for really experienced SENCOs.
Yeah.
Because things change.
They do.
And, you know, the landscape of education is constantly evolving. So how can SENCOs ensure they're up to date and avoid these potential pitfalls?
I think continuous professional development is key.
Okay.
So going to workshops,
right,
reading all those updates that come from the JCQ,
mm-hmm.
and connecting with other SENCOs to share best practice.
Right.
It's all about being proactive and committed to ongoing learning.
I imagine the online system can help with that.
I think so, yeah.
You know, having that updated information really readily available at your fingertips.
Yeah.
I think that could prevent a lot of those misinterpretations.
Absolutely.
Speaking of streamlining.
Yes.
There's been a welcome change regarding rest breaks for students with learning difficulties who also require extra time or a scribe.
Yes.
Can you explain that a little bit?
So previously, it looked as if a separate form needed to be completed for each of those.
Okay. Now that can all be confirmed on part one of Form 8.
Okay.
Much more practical for SENCOs.
Less paperwork.
Exactly.
Always good.
But I imagine there's still going to be some nuance when it comes to, you know, like the duration of those breaks.
Right. Like how long do those breaks actually need to be?
Yeah, so there is some guidance which suggests that a single rest break should typically be no more than 70 minutes.
Okay.
But there is flexibility built in.
Okay.
So some students might need a longer break than that because of their specific needs.
Right.
Others might need a break much sooner.
Right.
than the guidelines suggest.
So, for example, a student with a physical disability might need more time just to get to, you know, the designated rest area.
Exactly.
Yeah, whereas a student experiencing a panic attack might need a break right away.
Right.
It's all about that individual student need, isn't it?
Absolutely. And making those adjustments accordingly. And, you know, that flexibility extends to the evidence used to support access arrangement applications. And we know that there are really long waiting lists.
There are.
For services like SAMHS.
Yes.
Which is a real concern. And families can face those agonizing waits for assessment and diagnoses.
They can.
So how does the system address that problem?
So thankfully, the new guidance does offer some flexibility.
Okay.
So in exceptional circumstances, okay, SENCOs are allowed to use a SAMHS referral letter as evidence.
So even if the student hasn't had the formal diagnosis yet.
That's right.
The fact that they've been referred can be taken into account.
Yes.
When making these decisions.
Yeah. But it's important to say that this isn't a free pass.
Right.
There still needs to be a very strong case made as to why that student needs those arrangements.
Okay.
And detailed evidence from the school is crucial.
So things like teacher observations, work samples,
yep,
any records of intervention or support that students already had.
Exactly.
All of that really comes into play.
Yes. It's about painting that comprehensive picture,
right,
of the student's needs.
Of their needs. Yeah.
And demonstrating how those needs are impacting their ability to access the curriculum and perform in exams.
And just to clarify that flexibility isn't limited to just CareOHS referrals.
No, it's not.
Right.
The JCQ will actually accept medical evidence from a range of sources.
Okay.
So it could be specialists in private practice.
Yeah.
It could be specialists who practice abroad.
So really acknowledging that expertise and support can come from a variety of places.
Absolutely.
The priority is getting that student the help that they need.
Yes.
Speaking of, you know, fairness, let's talk about extra time in art exams.
Okay.
And I know that that's a topic that often, you know, sparks debate.
It does.
Because some people might be thinking, well, isn't art more about creativity and expression?
Yes. Yes.
Not speed.
It's a common misconception.
Right.
While art definitely does involve creativity, many art exams assess technical skills and processes.
Mm.
That can be really time consuming, particularly for students with certain disabilities.
So let's say a student with dyspraxia.
Yeah.
Who might struggle with fine motor control.
Yeah.
They're going to need that extra time just to physically execute the techniques.
Exactly. And that's recognized in the JCQ guidance.
Yeah.
They state that 25% extra time can be justified for students with conditions that affect their manual dexterity.
So it's really leveling the playing field.
Yes.
Allowing them to, you know, show off their artistic skills.
Yeah.
But not be penalized for something that's out of their control.
Absolutely.
Now, what about students with learning difficulties? Could they ever qualify for extra time in art exams?
It is possible.
Okay.
It's considered to be rare and exceptional.
Mm-hmm.
So you might have a student with dyslexia who might struggle with the written elements,
right,
of an art exam. So analyzing a piece of artwork or writing an essay about art history.
Yeah, because they're those elements,
yeah,
even though it's a visual subject,
absolutely,
there's still that reading and writing component.
Yeah.
That could really pose a challenge.
Yes. And in those cases, if there's clear evidence that learning difficulty is impacting a student's ability to complete the exam.
Right.
Within the standard time,
yeah,
extra time might be granted.
So it's really looking at, you know, looking at that holistic view of the student.
Yes.
And how, you know, their individual challenges might actually intersect,
yeah,
with the demands of a particular subject.
Yeah.
So it's not just extra time.
No.
There are new accommodations that have been formally added to the JCQ guidelines.
There are two new center-delegated arrangements, yeah, that have been introduced.
So just to clarify, these are arrangements that the school or college can grant.
Yes.
They don't need approval from the awarding body.
That's right.
But I imagine there are still, you know, guidelines and considerations.
Definitely.
Around those.
Yeah.
So what are these two new arrangements?
So we've got non-electronic headphones and music.
Non-electronic headphones being the key word there.
That's right.
So just simple ear defenders that block out sounds.
Yeah.
Not connected to the internet, not playing music.
Absolutely.
So this would be, you know, appropriate for a student who maybe gets overwhelmed.
Yes.
By the sounds of others writing or, you know, shuffling papers.
Exactly.
During an exam.
Yeah.
Okay, now when it comes to music.
Yes.
Again, careful consideration of playlists.
Absolutely.
Is needed to ensure fairness.
Yeah.
So no, you know, sneaking in a history podcast.
No.
During a history exam.
Definitely not.
Right, and the playlist would need to be vetted.
Yes.
To make sure there are no subliminal messages or lyrics.
Absolutely.
that could provide hints
Yes.
or answers.
Yes. It's about maintaining the integrity of that assessment
Yeah.
while providing appropriate support.
It's a fine line.
It is a delicate balance.
Now let's revisit the topic of computer readers for EL students, because this is another area that often generates a lot of discussion and sometimes, you know, misunderstanding, because, you know, it's tempting to assume that any student who doesn't speak English as a first language would automatically qualify for a computer reader.
Yeah.
But it's not that straightforward, is it?
It's not.
So can you talk us through the nuance there?
So the decision to use a computer reader for an EEL student shouldn't be based solely on their language background.
Okay.
We need to look deeper.
Yeah.
And consider whether their reading difficulties go beyond language acquisition and might indicate a learning difference like dyslexia.
So is it a language issue?
Yeah.
Or is it an actual learning difficulty that's affecting their reading and decoding?
Yeah. Okay. And that's why that thorough assessment and a strong understanding of the student's learning profile is so vital.
Mm-hmm.
If a student consistently struggles with reading, even in their first language,
right,
that might indicate a need for a computer reader regardless of their English skills.
Regardless of their English skills.
Yes.
Okay, and their experience with bilingual dictionaries. Yeah. And other assistive technology should also be considered.
Absolutely. So if those tools haven't been effective, a computer reader might be a much more appropriate accommodation.
Okay, so it's about finding the right tool for the job.
Exactly.
All right. Are you ready for a quick fire round of clarifications?
Yes, fire away.
Okay, first up, when can a Form 8 be rolled forward from GCSEs to Level 3 qualifications?
So Form 8 can be carried over if the student still needs 25% extra time or a scribe, and the S&CO believes that those arrangements are still appropriate and effective.
Okay, but what if a student needs more than that 25% extra time?
Then a new Form 8 and a fresh assessment would be needed.
Right. You can't just assume that those needs are the same.
Definitely not.
Okay, now what about Form 9? When does that need to be renewed?
So it depends on the level of the qualification.
Okay.
So it can be rolled forward for GCSE RISITs or Level 1 and 2 vocational qualifications.
Mm-hmm.
But a new Form 9 is needed for those Level 3 qualifications.
Okay, so the stakes are higher. And so the documentation needs to be
a bit more rigorous.
More rigorous.
Yeah.
Okay, now to clear up some confusion about computer readers versus human readers in English exams.
Okay.
I know there are specific rules around this.
There are.
So could you walk us through that a little bit?
So a computer reader is allowed in sections of an English exam that focus on reading comprehension.
Okay.
However, a human reader is not allowed.
And why is that?
So that's to prevent any potential bias or influence from the reader's tone or interpretation.
Oh, so it's to make it fair.
Exactly. Yeah. It's about ensuring that fairness and objectivity in the assessment.
Yeah.
And it's also worth noting that that's specific to English exams.
Right.
In other subjects like modern foreign languages,
mm-hmm.
a human reader might be allowed.
Oh, okay.
Depending on the assessment.
So always double check.
Absolutely.
Those subject specific guidelines.
Yes.
Okay, now for our final myth busting moment. Do schools really need to keep all of those assessment papers on file?
No, they don't. In case of an inspection.
No.
I've heard that.
Yeah. It's a common worry, but it's a misconception.
Okay.
Nick Late was very clear on this assessment. Papers are not required for JCQ center inspections.
So breathe a sigh of relief.
Yes.
Schools, you can free up some storage space.
Yeah. The focus of the inspection is on the process, not the raw data.
Okay.
So inspectors are primarily looking at the completed forms, the evidence used to justify the arrangements,
mm-hmm.
and the school's overall system for implementing access arrangements.
So it's really about, you know, transparency, accountability, and most importantly, that the system is serving its intended purpose, which is to support students and allow them to demonstrate their knowledge and skills fairly.
Absolutely.
It's all about creating that equitable and inclusive learning environment.
It is. You know, as we delve deeper into these changes, one thing that really stands out is this emphasis on individualization.
Yeah.
Moving away from these like one size fits all approaches to learning and assessment. That's a great point. And we've talked about how SENCOs are really taking the lead in determining, you know, the best course of action for each student.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens when students transition between schools or from secondary to further education?
Mm-hmm.
Does that individualized support transfer seamlessly?
It's a really good question, and it's an area where I think there's still work to be done to ensure that smooth transition. Nick brought up this idea of Form 8 as being a sort of passport to access arrangements. So ideally, that passport would travel with the student, be recognized by all institutions.
That makes sense. It would save so much time and effort and prevent students from having to, start from scratch with assessments every time they change schools.
Exactly. But the reality is, it's not always that straightforward. Some further education colleges, for example, might not fully accept a Form 8 that's carried over from a student's previous school, particularly if they're moving to level 3 qualifications, like A levels.
So what happens in those cases? Does the student need to go through a whole new assessment process?
Not necessarily. So while a new Form 9 might be required for those level 3 qualifications, the previous Form 8 can still provide valuable evidence to support the student's needs. So think of it like, providing a detailed travel history, even if a new visa is needed for that next
I
destination.
like that analogy. So it's not about starting from zero. It's about building upon that existing information and adapting it to the new context.
Precisely. And this highlights the importance of clear communication and collaboration between schools and colleges. During these transitions, it's about sharing information, understanding the nuances of those different qualification levels, and working together to support the students' continued access needs.
It sounds like those relationships between institutions are really crucial
They are.
for ensuring that, students don't fall through the cracks. Let's shift gears a little bit and talk about the bigger picture. How do these access arrangements and the philosophy behind them connect to the future of education?
That's a fantastic question and one that's worth pondering. We've been focusing on the specific mechanics of these arrangements, but what's really exciting, I think, is how they reflect a much broader shift in how we think about learning and assessment.
We're moving away from this idea that standardized exams are the only valid measure of a student's potential.
Absolutely. And these accommodations are a crucial step, I think, toward recognizing that students learn and demonstrate their understanding in diverse ways.
So instead of trying to, force everyone into the same molds, we're acknowledging that there are many paths to success.
And access arrangements are a way to create those different paths, to level the playing field, so every student has the opportunity to showcase their knowledge and skills in a way that works best for them.
It's about recognizing that what might be a barrier for one student could be a strength for another. And by providing the right support, we can help all students thrive.
I think that's a key point. It's not about giving certain students an unfair advantage. It's about removing unfair disadvantages that exist due to individual circumstances or learning differences.
It's about fairness, plain and simple.
Absolutely.
And, these changes also have implications beyond the exam hall.
They
We
do.
talked earlier about how the skills students develop through these accommodations can actually be really valuable in the workplace.
Absolutely. So things like self-advocacy, time management, knowing how to utilize support systems, these are essential skills for success in any field.
You're right. It's almost like we're not just preparing students for exams, but for life beyond school, for navigating a world that's, increasingly complex and demanding.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. And I think that's where the real power of these changes lie. They're not just about ticking boxes or following procedures, they're about fostering a mindset of inclusivity, flexibility, and individual empowerment.
And that's a mindset that benefits everyone, not just students with disabilities.
Absolutely.
It creates a more understanding and supportive learning environment for all. And, thinking back to what Nick said about, those sentients frequently asking him, "What do you think I should do?" It's understandable to seek that reassurance.
It is.
But I think it also reveals a tension that exists between following guidelines and exercising professional judgment. Because there's always that fear of getting it wrong,
There is.
of not providing the right support, or even of being accused of giving a student an unfair advantage.
That's where ongoing professional development becomes so crucial. It's about building confidence, staying up to date on the latest research and best practices, and connecting with other Senkos to share experiences and learn from each other.
It's creating a community of support and expertise
Is.
and recognizing that this work is complex
Yeah.
and constantly evolving.
And it's about trusting your own judgment, knowing that you are the expert on your students and their unique needs.
That's a powerful message, and it brings us back to the question that we posed earlier. If you could design an exam system from scratch, what would it look like?
Wow.
How could we ensure fairness and accessibility for all students?
That's a big question.
It is.
And there's no easy answer, but I think it starts with letting go of this idea that a single high-stakes exam can accurately capture the breadth and depth of a student's learning journey.
We need to move towards a more holistic approach to assessment, one that recognizes different learning styles, values diverse forms of expression, and allows students to demonstrate their understanding in multiple ways.
Exactly. Imagine a system that incorporates project-based assessments, portfolios, presentations, even performance-based tasks. A system that leverages technology to provide personalized learning experiences and flexible assessment options.
A system that truly values the individual.
Yeah.
And recognizes that success can take many forms.
It might sound idealistic.
Yeah.
But I think it's a vision worth striving for.
I agree.
And while we might not be able to completely overhaul the system overnight,
right,
we can advocate for these changes, push for innovation, and continue to challenge the status quo.
We can start by having those conversations.
Yeah.
By questioning assumptions and by imagining a future where education is truly equitable and inclusive for all.
And that's a conversation worth having.
Well said. And on that note, we've reached the end of part two of our deep dive into the world of exam access arrangements. Stay tuned for part three, where we'll explore even more insights and implications of these evolving access arrangements. Welcome back to the deep dive. We're continuing our exploration of exam access arrangements, and in this final part, we're going to zoom out and consider, you know, those wider implications
mm-hmm.
of these changes.
Yeah, it's easy to get caught up in the details
yeah.
of, you know, the forms, the guidelines, right. the specific accommodations.
Yeah.
But what's really fascinating, I think, is how these arrangements reflect
yeah.
a much bigger shift in educational thinking.
Yeah, we touched on this at the end of part two, talking about that move towards a more personalized and inclusive learning environment. But let's unpack that a bit more.
Okay.
What are the long-term impacts?
Well, for one, I think it challenges this traditional notion that a single standardized exam
right.
can accurately measure a student's abilities and potential.
Yeah, because we're starting to recognize that learning is a multifaceted process.
It is.
And students have, you know, different strengths, different challenges, mm-hmm. different learning styles.
Absolutely.
So instead of trying to force everyone into the same mold,
yeah.
we're acknowledging that there are many paths to success.
Exactly. And access arrangements are a way to create those different paths to level the playing field so that every student has the opportunity to showcase their knowledge and skills in a way that works best for them.
Yeah. It's about recognizing that what might be a barrier for one student could be a strength for another.
Mm-hmm.
And by providing the right support, we can help all students thrive.
And I think that's a key point. It's not about giving certain students an unfair advantage.
Right.
It's about removing unfair disadvantages that exist
right.
due to individual circumstances or learning differences.
It's about fairness, plain and simple.
Absolutely.
And, you know, these changes also have implications beyond the exam hall.
Mm-hmm.
We talked earlier about how those skills that students develop through these accommodations can actually be valuable in the workplace.
Absolutely. So things like self-advocacy, time management, knowing how to utilize support systems,
mm-hmm.
these are essential skills for success in any field.
It's almost like we're not just preparing them for exams, but for life beyond school,
yeah.
for navigating a world that's, you know, increasingly complex and demanding.
That's a great way to put it. And I think that's where the real power of these changes lies. They're not just about ticking boxes or following procedures.
Right.
They're about fostering a mindset of inclusivity, flexibility, and individual empowerment.
And that's a mindset that benefits everyone, not just students with disabilities. It creates a more understanding and supportive learning environment for all.
Absolutely.
And thinking back to, you know, Nick's comment about how those Senkos frequently asked him, what do you think I should do?
Yeah.
You know, it's understandable to seek that reassurance.
It is.
But I think it also reveals a tension
mm-hmm.
that exists between following guidelines and exercising professional judgment.
Yeah, because there's always that fear of getting it wrong.
Right.
Of not providing the right support.
Of giving a student an unfair advantage.
Exactly. And that's where that ongoing professional development becomes so crucial.
Right.
It's about building confidence, staying up to date on the latest research and best practices, and connecting with other Senkos to share experiences and learn from each other.
It's about creating a community of support and expertise.
It is.
And recognizing that, you know, this work is complex.
Yeah.
And constantly evolving.
And it's about trusting your own judgment, knowing that you are the expert on your students and their unique needs.
That's a powerful message, and it brings us back to that question we posed earlier. If you could design an exam system from scratch, what would it look like?
Wow.
How could we ensure fairness and accessibility for all students?
That's a big question.
It is a big question.
And there's no easy answer, but I think it starts with letting go of this idea that a single high-stakes exam
right.
can accurately capture the breadth and depth of a student's learning journey.
Yeah, we need to move towards a more holistic approach to assessment, one that recognizes different learning styles, values diverse forms of expression, and allows students to demonstrate their understanding in multiple ways.
Exactly. Imagine a system that incorporates project-based assessments, portfolios, presentations, even performance-based tasks. A system that leverages technology to provide personalized learning experiences and flexible assessment options.
A system that truly values the individual and recognizes that success can take many forms.
It might sound idealistic.
Yeah.
But I think it's a vision worth striving for.
Absolutely.
And while we might not be able to completely overhaul the system overnight,
right.
we can advocate for these changes, push for innovation, and continue to challenge the status quo.
We can start by having those conversations, by questioning assumptions, and by imagining a future where education is truly equitable and inclusive for all.
And that's a conversation worth having.
Well said. And on that note, we've reached the end of our deep dive into the world of exam access arrangements. I want to thank you for joining me on this journey and for sharing your incredible insights.
It's been a pleasure.
We encourage all of our listeners to continue exploring this topic. You can check out all of the resources mentioned throughout our deep dive. And of course, don't forget to subscribe to The Deep Dive for more insightful episodes.
Until next time.